distribution list, mono, what is it? It's like SOSH 929-F10 or whatever. You know, it has that. It, as groups begin to formalize and think about what they're doing, then you can send a message around to everybody with a little memo, as well, and I'll get it too. I will then post that memo on the website so it's there. But there's no reason not to just send it to everybody as well.
Yeah, did I sent out something last week just to see if it worked. It was like something about the ILO's social economy.
It worked.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Can you pass that down this way? Okay, so where were you?
Where was I?
Continue on that.
Right. So I just?
Yeah, we're okay.
One thing that, and I think it was the first person so far, I meant is kind of that they really focused on the kind of the literature more broadly, and issues about race and the reproduction of kind of inequalities in the alternative food movement. And you kind of mentioned issues about whiteness and markers of whiteness, which is, I think, really very common, you know, in the alternative food movement, certainly in Madison. Robert Pierce and the work that he's doing, you know, with the Growing Power, the Resiliency Center, South Madison stuff. I mean, he's an exception, but by and large, the anything that goes on in Madison that relates to alternative food or, you know, organic food is very white. And there's not a ton of research on it. And one of the things that I spent a lot of time doing a lot of reading on with that, and some of the the idea that it's a social justice-y kind of movement, and people feel very very proud of the fact that they're doing, you know, X number of things to support this movement. And then what's absent, and that Aicha also pointed out, is just the idea of, you know, laborers, you know, or, you know, who are the people that work on farms, which are largely minority, certainly in California is the case, and too large to be here, too. And you don't see that at the farmer's market when you go, because they're not, you know, selling produce, and you don't see this, you don't see the non-whiteness, with the exception of the mom community, which is fairly well represented at the market, I mean, at some of the markets in Madison, but. And then looking at some of the other ones that you talked about. Did you have anything particular about that? Just about the literature, or just kind of want to comment on that? Or?
Well, I mean, as I said to you before, yeah. It's because I first read the article, so I was really enraged by this entire movement. So and after I read Growing Power, it was like some kind of relief for me. So you know, that's why my interrogation is also biased towards the literature a little bit. But I think we talked about Growing Power's relationship with the conventional food system, and of course it's some kind of a collaboration, and how will we define it. So I think that's partly answered. And the other thing is, I mean, for example, I think we also covered this a little bit, for example, how can state support or this kind of like an organization like Growing Power, so, you know, tax and it's like subsidy or whatever we want to call it, support.
And the issue of localizing, you know, I think you talked about too, and the exclusionary nature of things that are local, and some of the politics that get ignored in the obsession sometimes with something that's local. Mm-hmm. I think it's really important in the literature, in particular for food. And again, you know, we've talked about how Growing Power addresses that, or at least subordinates that goal to other priorities, and I think appropriately so. But yeah, the state piece, you know, was something that I don't know that they get state, you know, I don't know if they get direct state money, you know, and I know that they, you know, yeah.
They have no
state. But they're urban, so maybe not. Yeah, so I'm not sure what the state's funding role is. you know, beyond their relationship to, you know, taking electronic benefits or, you know, accepting, you know, forms of state payment. I'm not sure what their role is in as far as broader levels. I know that they do stuff with the city of Milwaukee, like on a at that level.
Are they tax exempt? Because that would be a form of state support, mm-hmm. indirect.
Yeah. They're not a profit.
The organization would be tax exempt, but we don't know about the land.
But the land, yeah, for the city. I think that's a really key question. I'm excited.
I have a question regarding this. I mean, actually it's a question from last week, but I thought it wasn't really important, but it came up this week again. I mean, the land of lakes, we talked about lakes of land, land of lakes. I mean, those family farms, do they rely on a minority workforce to run their own farms? I mean, do they rely on Latino workers, for instance? I think you know more.
This is a very new thing. That in a generation ago they did not at all. They would hire people, hired hands, or you know, neighborhood people that were not didn't own land, and so you know, were available. That sort of disappeared, and I just happened to have this paper. There are now 12,551 hired workers on Wisconsin dairy farms. That's a lot of people, and 40% are estimated to be immigrants, and 80% of those immigrants are from Mexico. So it's very substantial, and that's family farms. But the size of dairy farms has grown. I mean, the economies of scale conversation is relevant, and you know.
And it's, to me, it's really important that really notion of, you know, family farms and all this, you know. Stuff that, you know, is somehow imbued in that concept of a family farm, you know, I think can get appropriated in ways that are unintentional, but I also think it can dupe people into thinking, oh, it's a family farm, and totally ignoring, you know, what it takes to run a farm and what people do in order to make, you know, to run a farm, you know, in whatever the labor situation is. I mean, certainly that's a
I was thinking about the whiteness in the food systems. I think it kind of goes with the environmentalism piece too. There's because like the environmental movement is often seen as a very white movement, but so if, and this was kind of like my concern about like the connections with the community, is that like there's this organization called the Environmental Justice Advocates of Minnesota, and they're pretty much based in minority communities, and the two things that they work on primarily is if you live in a community of color in Minneapolis, chances are that your soil is contaminated with arsenic because of industrial dumping. And that's bad if you want a garden, but it's also bad if your kids play in your yard because they don't wash their hands or getting arsenic in their bodies. And then the other thing is there's this group called Central Campesino who works with EJAM and like dealing a lot with chemicals and kind of like workplace safety conditions. So it's like not only educating like workers like what you need to wear masks and gloves, but also trying to change some of the labor standards. So I think like it depends like who has a voice. That like I don't think that AAM needs to be white or that environmentalism needs to be. It's just like how do you kind of provide these outlets for other people to have a say.
And it's not white, and I guess that's the thing. Yeah. You know, and it's the outcome it is. Mm-hmm. You know, but all the things that it takes to make it what it is, you know, isn't, and I think that's masked, and I think that's a major kind of issue, along with the racial things, and I, you know, the tenant farmers comment that you made about the percentage of African-American farmers. I haven't looked into that part of it, but I know that the, you know, when you look at land and who, you know, has owned land historically, you know, in the last 100 years, and who's been given loans, you know, there was a recent Supreme Court decision, you know, that granted reparations to African-American farmers who were denied loans, you know. So, I mean, there's this whole idea about, okay, these family farms, but how did you get to have that family farm, you know, and that stuff that's just masked and eliminated and not discussed and not talked about.
Catherine, can I I was enraged by these articles, but for, and not yours, but the other ones, but for a different reason, which is, you know, this is just, it just reminded me of sort of a classic circular firing squad on the left, right, where you're,
you know, metaphor.
You're picking off people who are trying to help, you know, groups that all of us would say want to be helped, you know, for labor problems, race, diversity problems, etc., which we all think, you know, I would assume are good goals to have. You don't want to have worse conditions, things like that. But it's my sense of U.S. agriculture that if we really want to help farm workers, you know, we have a 100-year history of labor standards and laws in this country, which are, you know, being eroded every decade, right? Which affects the 99% or more, you know, farm workers, rather than the very small number who are in these alternative, you know, type of agricultural production. You know, if you're really concerned about the plight of farm workers, mm-hmm. and racial diversity on farms and things like that, you know, look at ConAgra, look at mm-hmm. Tyson Foods, you know, the idea that you're going to hamstring, you know, the development of local organic food by making them meet a higher standard. Now, I mean, I can see there are areas where, like growing power, where you can bring together a whole bunch of issues and work on them all at once, community development, et cetera. But to go after farmers markets or CSAs, you know, with a higher standard than you do, because what do you do when you don't support those people? Well, most people are getting lots of calories from ConAgra and Tyson, you know. It just seems like the efforts could be better directed toward, not growing power, your particular piece, but the other ones. I mean, if you really want to help farm workers, you know, look at the majority of calories that people consume, and I'm guessing 99% of them are produced by agribusiness.
Yeah, I mean, I guess my initial response is I certainly wouldn't think that, you know, not supporting the vast majority of labor workers or trying to improve those conditions is a bad goal. I mean, I don't think that, and I don't think that, you know, focusing on this one, you know, necessarily suggests that not focusing on the other is not a good thing. I have one other thought. So the higher standard issue, you know, I guess I like there to be some accountability for rhetoric that gets used, and that was probably my initial motivation to do this, as I learned more about it and I found these other things, I felt like they deserved attention. And when I think about farm workers, I don't know that farm workers, somebody who doesn't have a lot of choice about where they're working, is going to say, well, I don't want to work on this farm, but I'd rather work on this one, or I'd rather work on this one. You know, I'm not sure that that's not a, I don't know, maybe, I mean, and I haven't interviewed farm workers, so I don't know, but, you know, I guess maybe that's an interesting question is, you know, how much do people care whether they're working on a family farm that's doing Land O'Lakes cooperative versus an organic farm versus a, you know, a farm that's local, you know, I don't know.
Is there evidence that the labor conditions on organic farms are in general worse than on large agribusiness farms? And I know there was this big controversy in California over the short-handled hoe, which was a problem that was specific to organic farms. That is, because of the lack of use of pesticides and herbicides, more intensive weeding had to be done by hand. So one of the added costs of organic farming on any kind of larger scale is that you have to do more weeding. Weeding can be done with various ways, but the most efficient way from the point of view of how much time it takes to do it is the short-handled hoe, because you get down and you do it, but it's very tough on people's backs. So the short-handled hoe is considered an occupational safety issue. And so there was legislation in California to ban the short-handled hoe. They just can't use it. It's too hard on people. And the organic growers combined with agribusiness to fight it. So you had this unholy alliance. So.
Well, and the other thing I think is that, you know, that's not a mutually exclusive group there. I mean,
but also small
are corporate agribusiness.
But I think this, yeah. this is, I think this Julie Guthman
yeah.
wrote this about, I think it's her piece that I read.
Okay.
I mean, she may be a little tendentious about how she frames it, but I believe it was the kind of normally thought of as the good guy organic association, which was the small, you know, non-agribusiness join forces with the agribusiness types to oppose the legislation.
And the thing about having like just better conditions on the farm is that like migrant workers aren't coming up here and they're like, which farm am I going to work at? Like they're usually recruited down in Eagles Point, Texas, and then they come straight here. So it's not like there's a slavery market and they're like, oh, this looks like a nice place to work.
The other thing that just comes to mind about the ConAgra stuff, I mean, you know, they're farms. I mean, there are families that are farming and selling their stuff to ConAgra, you know, and those are family farms. And wherever they are, whether they are, you know what I mean? I mean, I think the labeling of it, I have troubles with the labeling because I think, you know, and this is a local farm. It's like, well, you know, Tyson is local to the people that are living there. I mean, and the notion that there's something better, or you know, the size issue. You know,
so mostly ConAgra just has subcontracts to.
Yeah, there's lots of contract farming. I mean, families that you know.
Yeah.
As opposed to running their own large farms.
Yeah, in fact, most of them don't want their own farms, right? I mean, most of the big agribusiness
don't own
the
farms.
Own farms,
and they don't. Vertical integration is really only like in some livestock, like increasingly hogs and chickens for sure. And the people that own farms that are involved in those chicken things, I mean, that is one of the worst situations for the farm owners that exists. Much less the people that are in the factories cutting up those chicken. I mean.
Right.
It's
they
a
just
horror
squeeze
story,
their suppliers,
and so I agree with you that I thought these were, in fact, I thought especially this Realizing Justice Local Food System. I mean, these were excellent articles with really interesting things to say. But I guess I think in the scheme of things, who are we criticizing? I mean, there's so much room for work on you know the situation in the food system. It's so terrible.
So do I understand correctly with regard to these agribusiness firms that there's a large number of small or medium-sized landowners who rent their land out to the large corporation that then farms it for them?
No.
Is that what's looking like?
They sell their contract to supply their produce with their chickens.
They sell it on the market.
They purchase all the inputs from big agribusiness corporations and then they sell to the big agribusiness corporations.
But they have to cover up food risks.
They're small businesses that run the food.
So the business has no responsibility in terms of crisis.
If it doesn't work out, like it's the farmer that's messed up.
Well, those types.
Yeah, all the responsibility.
No, I just have about the responsibility of the state, or maybe you know, in regulating like labor conditions on these farms. I mean. From one perspective, when I think of these you know alternative food movements, I think that it's you know it's very because it's very decentralized and because it's like a niche, and so you know something a little bit something that has a broader focus to change the rules of the game is needed. That's one of the things that mm-hmm. comes to my mind. But on the other hand, we know that states is subsidizing these farms and all that. So it's basically kind of a part of a policy and or its outcome, which you know, has been going on since 1950s. I mean, in fact, with this, the idea that you know. Higher productivity is better in agriculture because these people had nothing to do and they're just that this has been implemented in many developing countries too and you know getting rid of the agriculture and mechanization and all that so it's and so on the one hand I'm really you know it may not be just the pressure of these corporations on the state but also a motivation on part of the state to enhance growth, and to more productive parts of the economy, like high tech stuff, because it's farming or agriculture is seen as something totally unproductive, or was seen at least. Of course, it's a changing structure and everything. It turns out to be something else. For example, I learned that the capital, intensivity of capital in agriculture is today in the U.S. is greater than steel. So that's also maybe something that challenges the older assumptions too. So
it's highest in the world, I guess. I mean, there's so much output, but only less than 5% of the labor force is employed in the agriculture.
I do think there is a larger issue of the state abdicating its responsibilities, right? I mean, if the people who are most vocal and concerned about good food and labor conditions and racial equality are participating in separate markets where they can say to themselves, hey, you know what? Well, my food is produced in the best possible way, meeting all these values, right? What happens to the other 98%? I mean,
I don't
want to have to worry about, choosing a label that tells me that my food's produced this way. Now, I want the state to take care of that, I want the state to make sure that workers are safe and well compensated and not poisoned at work. I mean, I don't want to be a part of a community that enforces that or determines that that's going on. That's the role of the state, in my opinion.
I wonder if I thought about your comment about the why focus on the small sector. And that is that, because for a lot of people, it's trying to be reproduced and it's trying to be expanded. And I think it'd be detrimental to expand it without correcting some of the issues that are part of that movement.
But
so
of
while
course.
Small, while small, its idea is to expand that. So.
But of course, there's the problem that if one of the obstacles to it expanding is that it's more expensive for consumers, and dealing with these social justice issues will just make it even more expensive, because social justice is, so to speak, expensive. It should be. So there is the problem that if you don't do it through the state, so it imposes the same conditions on all producers, but just do it through your social movements, focusing on the sectors that are most vulnerable to your ideological mobilization, that will also then constrain the growth of that sector.
And I would say too, I think there's a lot of people that would like it always to be an alternative, and there's that motivation of just, they appreciate that perpetual alternativeness of it. Okay. Tuhi?
I want to say another thing about, I think in terms of market walking, there is a possibility to expand, for example, there is a concept of fair trade, right? So we buy food, so consumers buy food, not just because of, see the value behind the product, right? So, this movement sector, talking about this movement sector is not just, there is a possibility to incorporate more value in the product, and by that can influence on the conventional market. Doesn't make sense.
No, it does, but I think I got to be really careful about what the values are. Like, how many people want less fossil fuels expended in their, the production of their food? I mean, how many of us would, if somebody came to you and said less fossil fuels, right? Well, I have a friend who's a illegal Mexican immigrant in Philadelphia, and when he came to the U.S., he was working, you know, picking asparagus in central California, and this is back-breaking labor, you know? And we need to produce a lot of food, a lot of calories for people to eat. And if you reduce the fossil fuel intensity or the carbon footprint of agriculture right now, what it means is we're going to import more people who are going to do back-breaking labor. I mean, this guy did this work for 2 years and now has back problems for the rest of his life. You know, so I mean, the idea of for people who are simply consuming to say like, oh, it should be less this, it should be less that, you know, when 99% of their calories are going to come through this industrialized farming, and to just demand changes, it's, you know, you've got to have a broad safety net, I think, before you say we want food to be X and Y without workers being able to have, you know, a basic living and health insured for them.
I mean, like environmental food, they mean. I mean, some alternative agro-food initiative began the practice, but now, like, Whole Food, like, jump in and they do that, right? In that way, if some sector, in small, if some small tech sector make its value, I mean, like, counting, I mean, if the product say about the, I mean, if there is some consumer group who want to buy product which is grown in the family farm, which treat the laborers better, workers better. I mean, if it became a Nikkei in the market, I mean, other companies can jump in and
so
accept. I mean, cooperating. And I don't know. Yeah.
So we have organic certification, and we have for forestry products. You know, environmental certification. One could imagine social certification for products. So you could buy goods that were produced only with people who earned living wages and had full benefits, and it would have a sticker on it. And then people could choose it. So that's a kind of market-based, that's the Milton Friedman solution. As Milton Friedman says, consumers should be able to buy expensive goods that are produced with, but the market should decide it, and so you should label it, certify it, and then if enough consumers want it, that will put pressure on firms to produce that way, as opposed to the state solution, which says that that is actually not a good strategy. It would actually be counterproductive, because it would give the appearance of a solution to this problem, and then it's just people's choices which is determining it. And it would because it basically is a way of depoliticizing. And now I feel ambivalent on this. I don't know. I do think it has to be enforced ultimately by the state. What I don't know is whether creating a equal exchange or fair exchange market with fair trade, with certification or forestry products that are certified so that consumers can choose, whether that also has a kind of consciousness-raising effect of making the issue more salient. And then when the historical possibilities of mobilization occur, it makes it easier to get state-enforced regulations increased. So what's unclear to me around this particular strategic issue is whether the decentralized, market-centered strategies of transparency and information is a obstacle to a more politicized enforcement of higher standards, or a stepping stone towards more politicized. And I don't have, you know, I genuinely don't know the answer to that question. I can argue it both ways.
One difficulty with information forcing and transparency is that it only goes on one side currently. That the costs for certifying the information is borne by the organic producers, and
right.
That the information isn't forced on the conventional side. That the default rule is that you can produce a genetically modified salmon, but you don't have to say that because right. you understand it is exactly the same as normal salmon flesh, so who cares?
So you have a label that says produced with high toxicity and...
Exactly. I mean, that's what conventional is, you know, produced with this amount of fossil fuels, and then that's very expensive to force all that information. But that's just not done.
Just to add what Steven said, I mean, a couple of years ago, I was thinking this along the same lines about this. I'm not very familiar with the terminology about the biodiesel and the biofuel, things like that, non-fossil things. I mean, I was just wondering why the all oil companies are advertising all this thing and that, and people were thinking environmental movements also sort of embracing this issue until I read an article from Fidel Castro. He was saying, if you keep producing fuel with all the wheat we have, he's just proposing a big famine in 20 years. I mean, if you suck in all the developing countries' wheat to make fuel for the developed countries, then there will be a famine in very soon in those countries. I found some similarity with terms of a dilemma between two issues.
And also, I mean, doesn't this also raise, that's what Nate mentioned, the whole issue of sustainability? I mean, you say it would be great to have a safety net, you know, of some form, but like, the question really is, you know, will we be able to have some kind of safety net, like, in a couple of decades, right? I mean, you know, with global warming, assuming that it's happening. Because I see this whole issue as like, either we switch now to this more organic, local, you know, kind of more cooperative style of farming, or like there will be no farming pretty much, right, at some point, because we won't be able to kind of implement the kind of technologies that then we implement, you know, the same kind of like, you know, kind of production style that we're implementing now. So it's just a question of not whether there will be a switch or not, but, you know, whether we're prepared for the switch that will come inevitably, right? I mean, does that make sense?
I understand that's what Nestle and companies are basically saying. Will there be any farming in the future? Right. In the discourse right now.
Where are they saying that?
I have a friend that's a professor at Michigan State, and he's been part of a EU-funded study that a lot of these big food companies participated and funded. And so he's going to present at a conference that I'll go to, but I was just very startled. And it was about water, basically. Yeah.
You mean this is extendable to any kind of
exactly.
commodity?
But it's
really.
Food. I mean, it's what they do. Yeah.
So, you know, not seeing the social economy only like kind of social terms, but like, you know, we should try to be fairer, you know, like more accessible to everyone. But I guess the ultimate issue is accessibility. You know, if we don't implement these kind of like different kind of organizational structures, there won't be any accessibility in the future. And this is kind of the only option. It's just a question of how fast you can spread it and how
so
widely.
I mean, that's the kind of catastrophist, apocalyptic view, which says that we are going to have a cooperative social economy eventually. Just do we institute it in the near future where it can be at a higher standard of living because we want to destroy the material foundations for it, or will it be instituted later where it will be bare subsistence because that's all that will be left? I'm myself fairly skeptical of the catastrophist views on this. I just think there's more play in the system than that seems to suggest, and that it's putting together too many different things. So we can certainly have agriculture that isn't organic, that isn't as healthy as we would like, that has pesticides and herbicides. That's not the main source of, that's not an important contributor to global warming. So if global warming is the mechanism by which we're not going to have any farming, global warming, moving against global warming does not require organic food. There may be good reasons for it. This is to say we don't have good reasons for organic food, but it's not the you know, the use of pesticides and herbicides that's contributing substantially to global warming. It's other features of the way we organize our economy and the use of energy and so on. Air conditioning is a much bigger contributor, for example, to global warming, I'm sure, than pesticides are. And air conditioning may well be one of the things that we'll be living without.
But that's really not what I meant. I meant exactly the other way around. I didn't mean the causation going from farming to global warming. I meant I'm kind of assuming that global warming is a fact, and that it's going the other way. That there won't be any pesticides. We won't be able to produce pesticides.
Why won't you be able to produce pesticides?
Well, because of like all kinds of like commodity shortages.
Or engage
in the kind of farming that that's just an example in farming, but engage in the kind of like production that we're producing now.
But I just don't. The catastrophist scenario, there's going to be a lot of suffering in the world, but I don't think the consequence of that is that you're not going to have farming. I mean, it's just not.
Yeah, not in the way we have it now.
But why not? Why can't you? Why is the way we have it now incompatible with a lousy world?
Huge water shortages.
Or fossil fuel dependency. Probably seven or eight calories of fossil fuel energy for every calorie.
It's dependent on the very few number of seeds which are adapted to a certain type of climate.
So, yeah, exactly.
Right, but so you. I'm not saying there's lots of pathology. Look, I'm not defending conventional agriculture. I think large corporations dominating our economy will continue to dominate the economy under the lousy conditions of a hotter world as they are now. That there's nothing in global warming which per se is going to destroy the possibility of large and powerful corporations dominating our economy. That's going to require a social movement and political action to challenge large and powerful corporations and having their organization. Their capacity to dominate will still be there. And it could even be strengthened. And catastrophes generally do not lead people, to go for, small and decentralized solutions. They get afraid. That's why the right wing loves catastrophes. The right wing gets stronger whenever there's a catastrophe, not weaker. So I'm just saying, I don't see why big, powerful corporations are going to necessarily, just by virtue of the ecological conditions, cease to be able to dominate the conditions of our choices.
Yeah, I would answer that, I would agree with you unless there's an alternative to the structure and organized society. For example, farming, which is like spread out enough that you can just, you have a choice. You can either let like the big corporation dominate your food supply, or you switch to like backbreaking organic kind of like innovation.
Well, I don't see the scenario where people will be able to freely switch from one to the other unless there's political, I think it's possible, but it requires political action. It's not going to happen. It's not by virtue of decentralized individual choice that people will just be able to switch from one system to another.
Maybe not. I mean, I just can see that, if every neighborhood grows its own food, there's a certain kind of there's a food security, a certain kind of subsistence security within that neighborhood, independent of any kind of greater structure, kind of greater economic and social structure around that neighborhood.
But there are political choices necessary in order to make sure that everybody has seeds that they can plant in their neighborhood.
For example, just theoretically, if growing power would spread the entire country with a little module, and the growing power movement would be sustainable on its own terms. Maybe through some taxation, maybe through some state support, but assuming that there were political will to do so, then the dependency on these greater, bigger organizations would be seriously eroded. Why I keep on banging on about the reproduction of these organizations, because I just wonder, if you can reproduce it, then.
Well, so the issue, I mean, that's an interesting proposition. You know, it's certainly one worth thinking. At the moment in the United States, 2% or so of the labor force produces more than enough food for the entire population, more or less. If it increased to 3%, it would certainly produce more than enough. So the food desert problem wouldn't be existing. We've got more than enough food produced with only a couple of percent. So the question is, could we produce enough food in neighborhoods, in cities, so that you wouldn't need proper, what we think of as organized agriculture, be all this decentralized stuff, without it meaning that 20% of the population would have to be engaged in that kind of urban agriculture, 25%, 30%.
Or it would be integrated in a completely different organization, society with schools.
Yeah, but still, in terms of the labor time available in the society, it'd be 25% of the labor time is being devoted to agriculture rather than 2%.
No, never. You don't have the land. I mean, a city like New York City, I mean, just the New York metropolitan area would need the entire rest of New York State and Massachusetts planted with, you know, low-intensity agriculture. Every single square inch would have, I mean, you need about an acre per person, probably more than that if you really want a diverse diet. And that's no wheat,
well,
no corn.
This
no
will just be tilapia. Tilapia and spinach.
Yeah. Watercress.
We'll have a watercress, tilapia, and spinach diet.
Yeah. But I mean, it goes to the point, too, where we import a ton of food. You know, we don't use our land for farming because we are able to buy it elsewhere, you know, other countries. We import it. So I think, you know, yeah, the idea of being, you know, independent in neighborhoods, you know, isn't really. I mean, to be completely independent is just not realistic. You know, we don't have the land. We have to change how we use our land in this country because we build over so much of it. And if you look at, like, you know, how imports have changed over the last, you know, 20 years, we import a ton more food now than we did 20 years ago.
We're still net exporters.
Yeah, but the amount of our land devoted to food production is, you know.
But that gets to the strategy, right? I mean, do you have the alternative, right, which develops on its own independently, which could, you know, sets, maybe it draws the market in by demonstrating need
and
a market. Or do you go after the 99% of calories that are produced, which it seems like we lost that one. Where, you know, whereas if you're, maybe the market isn't so dominated, like something like, you know, forestry or something like that, because I've worked on certification campaigns, I'm a big, you know, where we did environmental, economic, and social values in a label, you know, that we created called FSC, that, you know, it worked in some ways it didn't. But agriculture, you've lost, you know. I mean, we are entirely 100% virtually dependent on an industrialized, you know, capitalist agriculture system that's not locally based, that's terrible, you know, and we can't get off of it. You know, we need to change that system, not develop an alternative. Let me just come clean. You know, it's fantasy to think that we're going to be, you know, growing, you know, on our rooftops and producing enough food for, you know, a suburb or a urban community, you know, with the population densities that we have today. Just, how are you going to get all those people out to their plots of land that are now, you know, the nearest one's 100 miles away? I mean, you just...
So you're more supportive than, I mean, it occurs to me, you know, then that you're happier with the idea of large-scale companies, you know, like Kellogg's or whatever, doing organic. Right?
I would.
Over,
I wish,
right?
Those large-scale companies were owned by the people who lived in the city that they were feeding. That would make it all, you know, and they were doing it in the best environmental and labor possible way. But the idea that we're going to break down the sort of industrial infrastructure and somehow localize production and feed enough people is, I mean, you know, maybe with algae and things growing in water near cities, I don't know, but, you know, maybe there is an alternative future, but in the near future, you know, it seems just fantasy to me. I mean, I just don't see how it works.
But that's a good strategy then. I mean, in your eyes, right, would be to have those companies in the conventional, right, food production. What alternative people would say, they're co-opting what we do. That's actually a desirable aspect of it, right? Because it takes some of the elements, right, of it and applies it on a broader scale.
Yeah, I think you have no choice but to engage these these companies, unless you can replace them with something, you know, and or nationalize them. Start there, you know. Yeah. Start by nationalizing Archer Daniels Midland and ConAgra.
I mean, what you have no choice is to engage with the land distribution and land setup as it is. Even if those companies go away, you still have the farmland that's far away from the population centers. So if then the state comes in or some form of social ownership arises that deals with them, it's not the companies per se, it's the land distribution, if I'm understanding your point correctly, that's the problem.
No, it's the fact that the that you have concentrated people in cities has some very big advantages to it. There's lots of efficiencies around transportation and that's high density urban living solves. It makes it harder for those people to also grow their own food. So that's solved by other means. So the if you got rid of these large industrial capitalist firms that dominate the food system, that would make it possible for the practices on the in the food production side to change, but it would also make it more expensive. I mean, it would make, you know, our food is cheaper than it should be. Mm-hmm. It would make food more expensive. It would therefore mean that a higher percentage of people's total time will be spent in food, either because there'll be a larger agricultural population or because people are simply spending more of their income on food. And that's one of the, I think, inherent consequences of a social justice agenda around agriculture, as in other social justice agendas. You don't think that's right?
No, I guess I was just going to say that already we I wish I knew the numbers, but I mean, we spend a lot of our tax dollar, not really, I mean, not compared to defense, but there's a very significant amount of money that is already really going to agriculture. So it's a really complicated question. I mean, you could presumably shift those subsidies, you know, keep the same amount of money going to them, but radically shift where what portion of agriculture you're subsidizing and what values you're subsidizing, and not affect our food prices really at all. Yeah, that's I think an important thing.
I think one of the interesting things about these projects also is that they're trying to change tastes on the demand side. You know, if you teach kids to eat vegetables and to like that, then maybe that's displacing Burger King or something. Because I think a large part of, you know, corporate domination and the pathologies of the industrial food system is that the subsidies go to creating red meat and chickens.
Exactly. Mm-hmm.
And so if food gets more expensive, people may spend more time working at food, but they may also trade off to things that cost less and are healthier. Mm-hmm. And that people aren't going to do that unless they're exposed to it at a young age.
I mean, an apple shouldn't cost more than a bag of potato chips, you know. But
mm-hmm.
It does.
Or a hamburger.
Mm-hmm. Why don't we go back to the list just for sure? No, this is fine. It's fine, but it would be good if there's a couple more, I think, still.
Okay, so to you. So that was kind of like your core question was about how practical the concept of organic or of local is, or is the concept itself too muddy to be useful because it requires too much caution to be a useful concept. We talked about that kind of to some degree. I mean, my take on it is, you know, local is not inherently good, and the use of the term is not. Is overall not effective. It's not useful. I don't find it to be very useful. I mean, it's to know where your food is from. But my example is always like Tyson is local. I mean, Oscar Mayer is local. I mean, like, you can get, you know, bologna really quickly. And, you know, it just doesn't embody a lot of the things that I think people that tend to use that in the buy local campaign.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there is the economic aspect of it, and, you know, if you spend dollars locally with local labor, that, you know, you distribute that money locally, so it's some economic benefit to local, you know, but that it suggests a lot of other things, I'm not sure I find it to be terribly useful.
I mean, so not just in agro-food business, but also in other social economy organizations, I think they use Tom Verlath, like benefiting the community, I mean, not local community, like retaining wealth in community. I mean, that kind of phrasing is, I think, used a lot in many social economic organizations and cooperatives. I mean, so you think the local encompass so many things, and something are useful, but something is not useful.
I mean, local. I don't think it assumes anything. I guess is what I like to think of it as, and I think the term is often used. And when you ask what that means, it means 12 different things. Mm-hmm. When to somebody, and I just think that there's nothing besides distance. Mm-hmm. There's nothing that you can assume about local, except that there's probably a lot of reproduced inequality that happens to the people that are in that community, and was there other stuff that related to that? Do you want to talk about?
One more thing I was thinking. I mean, like controllability, in terms of controllability. Sometimes, it's more easier to control when I see when it happened in my community, but it's decided in other place. I understand the concept of local is, it means too many things, but I'm just saying it's used a lot.
Like your needs better, right, on a local level, versus if you had a state impose something or something that was regional or national. So from that perspective, I think, your local groups can decide things maybe better. But there's also less accountability at the local level, and I think that there's examples either in one of the articles or something about, agents, agricultural agents that worked on a local level that had no accountability to the state or to the national, I think
it's not useful.
I just find it very muddy, is your term.
Just to some extent, I think it's a byproduct of another set of concerns in contemporary social movements and democratic political change, which has to do with the importance of direct democratic involvement and participation, which involves dense networks and reciprocities. Sometimes the term social capital is used, trust and so on. And there is, a common view, which probably has some real merit, that implies local interactions have a privileged standing with respect to overall strategies, because that's where you can build those kinds of reciprocities and solidarities of a face-to-face character, which are important for the sustainability of participation over the long haul. And so the implication of that, then, if that's a kind of general view on the social movement left, that has where it has a kind of democratic and egalitarian core to its values. And then if you share those views and then you're confronting the agro-food system and you're interested in good food and all of that, then I think it sort of naturally says, well, we should think, as I say, think globally, act locally. So it then privileges the context where you can have all this face-to-face reciprocity and so on. I think part of the local food stuff isn't actually specific to food. It just comes from this general view about the importance of those kinds of relations.
I think in that case, the actual participation of it, the actual that I can actually be there is something that, now is certainly different, than when you look at kind of internet-based participation in things and whether or not things can be reproduced virtually or not.
At Farmville.
The other thing with local food stuff, I always
get it. You know, there's the definitional issue, you know, of what is local, you know, 25 miles or 50 miles. If you live 1 mile over that, then, you know, that's not good. And let's get our, you know, and then I get into the whole, like, local food of Wisconsin. Let's get other people in other states to buy local Wisconsin food, you know. And I don't think it's inherently anything. All right. Let's see, Nate.
I think we've hit a lot of these.
Yeah, I think so.
Most of them, I would say.
You know, the one issue that you raised, though, is the seasonality of it, you know, and labor, and whether that differed than other, you know, non-ag social economy sectors. Maybe there was some element of it that might be different. I'm not sure if it, you know, but I'm just kind of thinking out loud that that's, I think that's an interesting take on it in terms of difference or distinction, especially when you consider kind of migrant labor and how, you know, the seasonality of it affects families that are working on farms in different regions, you know, and have to move quite a bit in order to adjust their. I don't know if there's other sectors that probably construction would be a similar seasonal sector to some degree that requires a lot of labor. I mean,
tourism.
Part of growing power is shtick. That was 365 day a year, mm-hmm. fresh produce. In cold climates, so
right, that you can.
So that particular model would actually.
Right, you can do a lot with hoop houses, but you can't lengthen the daylight hours. I mean, so there are some limits to seasonality, even with hoop houses.
You get that heat from the worms to
light run, a glow bulb or something?
to run fluorescent light, you know, grow lights.
Well, he does that tomorrow. I mean, if they show us for Saturday, you know, one of the neat things they do with kids that come through is have them guess the heat on the inside of their compost heaps. Because they've ordered the hoop houses, right, that generates all the heat from, you know, inside those hoop houses, which are remarkably warm in the winter. Mm-hmm. You know, and the kids are always just, how can it be over 100 degrees in there? You know, I mean, just really amazed at that concept of heating things in the winter just by,
you know, worms.
So by worms. Let's see. It's coming up. Right. Yeah, so other stuff I think was okay. From your thing, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then Taylor had, I was interested in that, kind of that, the tourism. In Turkey, related to this notion of organic villages and, you know, for the upper middle class vacations. Mm-hmm. And, I was interested just in a little bit of that, if you could talk to that.
Well, it's. This organic stuff is basically. Sort of recent. I mean, maybe it might be older, but being a part of a common language and. Support organic, do this for organic. And this issue is really recent, I mean, 5-6 years old, maybe 10. And I mean, the organic production from my point of view is necessarily pointing to upper middle class. There's, I mean, very downtown farmers market. Although farmers markets are really common in Turkey. I mean, every city, every town, every village has its own farmers market.
For a long time. That's
for a long
time.
Yeah. It's not a rich. It's different. But, I mean, this issue became, I mean, there's advertisements. I mean, the Western Anatolia, which is a really natural beauty in the middle of the forest, and people go there, they don't have electricity. And they're basically, I mean, these expensive vacation areas. That's why, I mean, I never bought anything from what is that? Villa Street Co-op. I never eat organic. I think it's it has a lot of baggage. for me, the organic, the healthy stuff.
Healthy food in general has a lot of baggage.
Yeah. Only Cheetos, please.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's... No, I mean, it's a big, it's, the, I mean, the, or the agriculture in Turkey in bigger, in a huge crisis. I mean, especially, I mean, the agriculture is in decline. I mean, the it was an agricultural economy for hundreds and hundreds of years. And it's the changes in the world affects Turkey as well, because in 2000, the world population living in urban areas passed the world population in rural areas, and every country is affected by it. But in a couple of years ago, there was a law which defines from which seed providers the small farmers are allowed to buy their seeds. I mean, those are only certified multinationals. They're the ones only to have the right to sell seeds to the farmers, who are the source of the biodiversity. And all those biodiversity is taken over by some central farmer. I mean, state is running this. I mean, state is. In terms of this social economy, state and these relationship, I mean, state screws the agriculture in Turkey, and it's not very really capitalist at all. I mean, even in the United States, I mean, it doesn't work really market principles, right? And I mean, that's why I mean, it's a huge issue. I've never been really on top of the food issue at all throughout my life, but it's always. I mean, strike my attention. That's why I was emotional and I referred to Turkey, etc. Although, I mean, I also got the assignment for today. Although, I mean, I didn't really give feedback to you. I mean, I again wrote an interrogation. I'm sorry about that, but I mean, I think there's nothing useful for you to further develop on the project for me from my point of view. But yeah, organic food is, I mean, it's like the microcredit thing. I mean, you see news or ads, like heroes who are producing their own organic food and selling to this and becoming rich. I mean, these dreams for people, or producing organic and selling it to really high niche markets and filling their own pockets. But I mean, nothing about being social, sharing, and community.
Exactly.
I mean, it starts, I mean, organic production starts screwing your old village neighbor. I mean, starting with your neighbor, because you produce less for the community, but starting with your own community.
Yeah.
So, but of course, I mean, after I came to States, my horizon widened a lot about organic food. Still.
I think it's interesting. I mean, in Korea, for example, the organic agriculture was kind of strategy against, I'm under the pressure of U.S., imported U.S. agriculture, and the pressure, cheap and very chemicalized agro-food. And so the farmers cannot compete with this U.S. imported agriculture. So that was a strategy, I mean, farmers to survive, actually, to keep the agriculture.
So Korean agriculture became defined by organic.
Yeah, I mean, it's not. I mean, it's a small sector than the. I mean, it's not that big sector, but it's like the people who actually devoted to organic are the people who actually, I mean, have been fighting against the government policy, like the trading. I mean, they give them. They trade off between the farm, I mean, agriculture and like the other industry. Like they, I mean, with the, I don't know. So, yeah. It's different. Like,
It's almost 5:30, I think.
Can I just say thank you to everybody? I feel like I hope it was somewhat interesting. I just feel like it's a whole lot of time spent on this.
I mean, I certainly got a ton out of it, and I hope people felt like
different
people or interesting, at least in some form.
Jaime, applaud you.
Well, we're all primed for growing power.
Absolutely.
On Saturday. Everybody has a map who needs a map, and everybody's got their locational.
I don't drive. Why do I need a map?
Excuse me.
I'm totally confused today.
So.
I'll probably sit at the back and, you know, check the map. You're not.
Quarter till 1 o'clock. 1 to 1, we will.